Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mind, Consciousness, Prediction, and the Brain by E. Bruce Goldstein. Narrated by Mike Lenz. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures and tables included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. Here's a problem. Write a short book, under 50,000 words, titled The Mind. What do you include? This crux of this problem is that the mind is responsible for everything we experience, as well as lots of things we are unaware of that create our experience. It is about perceptions, physical movements, reading and listening, thoughts, emotions, and interactions with others, among other things. So, at the outset, let's establish that it is impossible to cover the mind in 50,000 words, or, for that matter, even in multiple full-length volumes. Nonetheless, I thought I'd give it a try. My starting point was a course I was teaching for the Osher Lifetime Learning Institute, OLLI, at the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Arizona, and Carnegie Mellon University, titled Your Amazing Mind. My OLLI course begins with three questions. What is the mind? What is consciousness? And what happens in the mind that we are not conscious of? This discussion leads down many interesting byways. What is it like to be conscious? Are non-human animals conscious? Can we know what someone else is experiencing? Is it possible that making a decision involves an unconscious process? And inevitably to the brain, which not only creates all of our experiences, but accomplishes that creation largely behind the scenes, outside of our awareness. After covering these topics in chapters 1 through 3, and with about 25,000 words to go, I faced a decision: how to go beyond this basic introductory material to cover specific cognitive capabilities like perception, memory, language, and everything else the mind does. Because I did not have the space to devote a separate chapter to each of these capacities, I decided to focus on a principle that holds across cognitive capacities. That principle is the principle of prediction, figuring out what is going to happen next. And in chapters 4 and 5, I consider eye movements, visual object perception, tactile sensations, language, music, memory, and social interactions. What unfolds over these two chapters is the idea that there is a process that operates across many different capacities. But as I tell this story, it also becomes apparent that this process actually comprises many different processes. Predicting where the eye is going to move next and predicting what a person is going to do next involve an automatic, mechanistic process in the case of the eye, and a much more cognitive process in the case of the person. What this means is that prediction has a lot to teach us about the mind in general. In addition, we can discuss prediction at both the behavioral level, how does prediction operate as we read, and the physiological level, how is neural firing affected by how predictable a sentence is. Finally, the last chapter. What should it be about? In early drafts, I outlined chapters on mind wandering, thinking, and social interaction, each of which are important behaviors. But in the end, I looked back at the chapters about prediction and asked myself, what do all the behaviors and psychological processes associated with prediction have in common? One answer is that they all include communication between different places in the brain. Because these connections are so central to prediction, and to most other cognitive processes as well, it seemed like a good choice for the final chapter. After all, the mind, which is created by the brain, emerges not from the firing of neurons in one specialized area, but from communications that travel across what could be called highways of the mind. Thus, although this book does not cover the field, it does provide an introduction to age-old questions about the mind, while also describing current research, some of which is moving so quickly that 10 years from now, we may be looking back on this research as the beginning of something big. So I invite you to engage in this book, which, although it is brief, will give you a taste of some of the exciting things we know and are finding out about the mind. 1. Introduction to the Mind. 16 years ago, a patient I will call Sam suffered injuries that put him into a coma from which he never woke up. He showed no signs of awareness or ability to communicate. Observing Sam lying in the care facility, it wouldn't be unreasonable to conclude that there's nobody in there. But is that true? Sam doesn't move or respond, but does that mean he doesn't have a mind? Is there any probability that his eyes, which appear to be vacantly staring into space, could be perceiving, and that these perceptions might be leading to thoughts? These are the questions Lorena Nachi and co-workers were asking when they placed Sam in a brain scanner that measured increases and decreases in electrical activity throughout his brain, and then showed him an 8-minute excerpt from an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents called Bang, You're Dead. In this TV program, a 5-year-old boy finds his uncle's revolver, partially loads it with bullets, and begins playing with it in his room, making believe he is firing it, saying bang, bang, but not actually pulling the trigger. The drama escalates when the boy enters a room where his parents are entertaining a number of people. He points the gun at people threateningly, saying bang, bang, to pretend he is shooting. Will he pull the trigger and actually shoot? Will someone be killed? These questions race through most viewers' minds. There was a reason Hitchcock was called the master of suspense. At the end of the film, the gun goes off. The bullet smashes a mirror. The boy's father grabs the gun, and the audience breathes a sigh of relief. When this film was shown to healthy participants while they were in the scanner, changes in their brain activity were linked to what was happening in the movie. Activity was highest at suspenseful moments, such as when the child was pointing the gun at someone. So the viewers' brains were not just responding to the pattern of light and dark on the screen, or to the images on the screen. Their brain activity was being driven by what they were seeing and by the movie's plot. And, here is the important point, to understand the plot, it was necessary to understand things that were not specifically presented in the movie. Like why the gun is important. It is dangerous when loaded. What guns can do. They can kill people. And that the 5-year-old boy was probably not aware of the danger that he could accidentally kill someone. So, how did Sam's brain respond to the movie? Amazingly, his response was the same as that of the healthy participants. Activity increased during periods of tension and decreased when danger wasn't imminent. These findings indicate that Sam was not only seeing the images and hearing the soundtrack, but reacting to the movie's plot. His brain activity therefore indicated that Sam was consciously aware. So someone was in there. This story about Sam, who appears to have a mental life despite appearances to the contrary, carries an important message as we embark on the adventure of understanding the mind. Perhaps the most important message is that the mind is hidden from view. Sam is an extreme case, because he can't move or talk. But you will see that the normal mind also holds many secrets. Just as we can't know exactly what Sam is experiencing, so we do not know exactly what other people are experiencing, even though they are able to tell us about their thoughts and observations. And although you may be aware of your own thoughts and observations, you are unaware of most of what is happening in your mind. This means that as you understand what you are reading right now, hidden processes are operating within your mind, but beneath your awareness, that are making this understanding possible. As you listen to this book, you will hear how research has revealed many of these secret aspects of the mind's operation. This is no trivial thing, because your mind not only makes it possible for you to read this text and understand the plots of movies, but also is responsible for who you are and what you do. It creates your thoughts, perceptions, desires, emotions, memories, language, and physical actions. It guides your decision-making and problem-solving. It has been compared to a computer, although your brain computer outperforms your smartphone, laptop, or even a powerful supercomputer on many tasks. And, of course, your mind does something else that computers can't even dream of, if only they could dream. It creates your consciousness of what is out there, what is going on with your body, and, simply, what it is like to be you. In this book, we will be exploring what the mind is, what it does, and how it does it. The first step is to look at some of the mind's achievements. As we do, we will hear that the mind is not monolithic, but multifaceted, involving multiple functions and mechanisms. The multifaceted mind. One way to appreciate the multifaceted nature of the mind is to consider some of the ways mind can be used in a sentence. Here are a few possibilities. Number one, he was able to call to mind what he was doing on the day of the accident. The mind, as involved in memory. Number two, if you put your mind to it, I'm sure you can solve the math problem. The mind as problem solver. Number three, I haven't made up my mind yet. Or, I'm of two minds about that. The mind as decision maker. Number four, I know you well enough to read your mind. Or, you read my mind. The mind as involved in social interactions. Number five, he is of sound mind and body. Or, he is out of his mind. The mind as involved in mental health. Number six, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. The mind as valuable. Number seven, he has a beautiful mind. Some people's minds are especially creative or exemplary. These statements tell us some important things about what the mind does. Statements 1, 2, 3, and 4, which highlight the mind's role in memory, problem-solving, decision-making, and interacting with other people, are related to the following definition of the mind. The mind creates and controls functions such as perception, attention, memory, emotions, language, deciding, thinking, and reasoning, as well as taking physical actions to achieve our goals. Statements 5, 6, and 7 emphasize the importance and amazing abilities of the mind. The mind is something related to our health. It is valuable, and we consider some people's minds extraordinary. But one of the messages of this book is that the idea of the mind as amazing is not reserved for extraordinary minds. Because even the most routine things, recognizing a person, having a conversation, deciding what food to buy at the supermarket, become amazing when we consider the properties of the mind that enable us to achieve these familiar activities. What exactly are the properties of the mind? What are its characteristics? How does it operate? A book called The Mind has a lot to explain. Not only does the mind do a lot, but just about everything the mind is asked to achieve turns out to be more complicated than it first appears. Take, for example, opening your eyes and seeing a scene before you. You might think seeing the scene can't be that complicated, because, after all, light reflected from the scene creates a picture of the scene on the retina that lines the back of your eye. One reason for the difficulty of perception is that the picture of the scene on the retina is ambiguous. When the three-dimensional scene out there is represented by a picture on the flat surface of the retina, objects that are at different depths in the scene can appear right next to each other in the picture. If this isn't obvious from looking out at the scene around you, close one eye, hold up one of your fingers, and place it next to a faraway object in the scene. When this scene with superimposed finger becomes the picture on the retina, the finger and object appear adjacent to each other, even though they are far apart in the scene. The mind solves this adjacency problem, plus many others, so that we don't have to deal with them. We just open our eyes, and we see. Another example of something we achieve easily in the face of great complexity is understanding language. The stimulus for language, like the stimulus for perception, can be ambiguous, with the same word having different meanings, depending on the contents and structure of the sentence it appears in. Consider the following two sentences. Number one, time flies like an arrow. Number two, fruit flies like a banana. Many things are going on in these sentences, including different meanings for flies. One, flies equals moves. Two, flies equals a type of bug. And like. One, could replace like with similar to. Two, could replace like with appreciate. Even simple, apparently straightforward sentences are more complicated than they appear. When we read, "A car flew off the bridge," we are pretty certain that the car doesn't have wings and isn't a special kind of flying machine. In fact, we would probably be right to guess that the car was involved in an accident, that it may have been submerged in water or smashed on the ground, that the bridge possibly sustained some damage, and that the driver was in danger of being injured or worse. All these conclusions from a simple six-word sentence. As we describe how the mind tames the complexities of perception, language, and many other abilities, we will begin to appreciate that the mind is not simply an identification machine that catalogs objects and meanings, but a sophisticated problem solver that uses mechanisms we are largely unconscious of. We will also see that these hidden mechanisms often use knowledge that we have accumulated about the world. We know, from past experience, that when a car flies off a bridge, it is unlikely that it will actually fly. As we begin exploring the complexity of the mind's operation, we will be looking at a number of the functions listed in our definition, but we'll narrow our focus by considering just some of the mind's functions. We will narrow our focus further by basing our discussion on discoveries made using the scientific approach, in which hypotheses about the mind are tested by making controlled observations or running experiments. The scientific approach to the study of the mind has had an interesting history, which one could describe, with a nod to the Beatles, as a long and winding road. Approaches to the mind. We begin our discussion of the scientific study of the mind by considering an experiment by Franciscus Donders, which highlights the fact that we can't directly measure the mind. Donders' pioneering experiment. The first attempts to measure the mind in the scientific laboratory began in the mid-19th century in the laboratory of Franciscus Donders, 1818 to 1889, professor of physiology at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands. Donders' goal was to determine how long it took for a person to make a decision. He answered this question by measuring reaction times under two conditions. In the first condition, measuring simple reaction time, the participant sees a light flash on a screen and pushes a button as quickly as possible. The reaction time is the time between when the light appears and when the button is pushed. In the second condition, measuring choice reaction time, there are now two lights. The participant's task is to press the left button if the left light flashes and the right button if the right light flashes. This condition involves the decision, which button should I press? Donders found that the choice reaction time was about 0.1 seconds longer than the simple reaction time, and so concluded that it takes 0.1 seconds to make a decision in this situation. But the real importance of this experiment is in Donders' reasoning, which we can appreciate by considering the diagrams in Figure 1.1. In both the simple condition, Figure 1.1a, and the choice condition, Figure 1.1b, the time between the stimulus, lights flashing, and the behavioral response, pushing a button, is measured. The mental response, seeing the light, deciding which button to push, is not measured. The fact that it took participants 1/10 of a second longer to respond in the choice reaction time condition caused Donders to infer that this was the extra mental time that it took to make a decision. Think about Donders' method. To determine how long it took to make a decision, he assumed that the additional mental activity in the choice task involved deciding which light had flashed and which button to push. He did not actually observe people making these decisions, so he inferred that these invisible decisions were what caused the slower response. Donders was joined in the late 19th century by other researchers of the mind. The German psychologist Hermann Ebbinghaus, 1850 to 1909, studied memory by determining how accurately lists of nonsense syllables like IUL, ZRT, or FXP can be remembered after different delays. The data he collected enabled him to determine forgetting curves, which plotted the decrease in the number of syllables remembered as a function of the time after they had been presented. Ebbinghaus's results were important because they were one of the first demonstrations that characteristics of a function of the mind, remembering in this case, could be plotted on a graph. In the late 19th century, the study of the mind was off to a promising start, but just as momentum was building, events occurred that caused the study of the mind to come to a screeching halt. One of the events was Wilhelm Wundt's 1832 to 1920 founding of the first laboratory of experimental psychology at the University of Leipzig in 1879. Wundt's contributions, treating psychology as a science and establishing psychology as a separate field, were extremely important. But his preferred method, analytic introspection, contributed to the abandonment of the study of the mind in the early 20th century. Analytic introspection was a procedure in which a participant was asked to describe his or her experience. For example, in one experiment, Wundt asked participants to describe their experience of hearing a 5-tone chord played on the piano. One of the questions Wundt hoped to answer was whether his participants were able to hear each of the individual notes that made up the chord. Although self-report data of this kind were to reappear in psychology laboratories more than 100 years later, the results from Wundt's lab turned out to be highly variable from participant to participant. This variability bothered John B. Watson, 1878 to 1958, who in 1900 was a graduate student in the psychology department at the University of Chicago. He also did not like that researchers had no way to check the accuracy of the participants' description of their experience. Watson decided, therefore, that some changes were in order if psychology was going to be considered scientific, and he proceeded, with great enthusiasm, to banish the study of the mind from psychology. The study of the mind is suspended by behaviorism. Progress on studying the mind was put on hold in the early 1900s by Watson's founding of behaviorism. The flavor of behaviorism is captured in the following quote from Watson's 1913 paper, Psychology as the Behaviorist Views It. Psychology, as the behaviorist sees it, is a purely objective, experimental branch of natural science. Its theoretical goal is the prediction and control of behavior. Introspection forms no essential part of its methods, nor is the scientific value of its data dependent upon the readiness with which they lend themselves to interpretation in terms of consciousness. What we need to do is start work upon psychology making behavior, not consciousness, the objective point of our attack. In this passage, Watson rejects introspection as a method and proclaims that observable behavior, not events occurring in the mind, which involves unobservable processes such as thinking, emotions, and reasoning, should be psychology's main topic of study. To emphasize his rejection of the mind as the topic of study, he further stated that psychology need no longer delude itself into thinking that it is making mental states the object of observation. 163. In other words, Watson restricted psychology to behavioral data and rejected the idea of going beyond those data to draw conclusions about unobservable mental events. Watson's most famous research paper described his Little Albert experiment, in which Watson and Rosalie Rayner used the classical conditioning procedure also used by Ivan Pavlov. In experiments begun in the 1890s, Pavlov paired food and a bell to cause dogs to salivate when they later heard the bell. Watson paired a loud noise with a small rabbit, which Albert had previously liked, to cause Albert to become afraid of the rabbit. Conditioning, according to Watson, provided explanations for many human behaviors, without having to make inferences about what is going on in the mind. As behaviorism became the dominant force in American psychology, psychologists' attention shifted from asking, "What does behavior tell us about the mind?" to, "What does the way people or animals react to stimuli tell us about behavior?" Later, B.F. Skinner, 1904 to 1990, developed a procedure for measuring behavior called operant conditioning, in which rats and pigeons pressed bars to receive food rewards. Using this procedure, Skinner was able to demonstrate relationships between schedules of reinforcement, how often and in what pattern rewards were dispersed when animals pressed the bar, and the animal's bar-pressing behavior. For example, if a rat is rewarded every time it presses the bar, its rate and pattern of bar pressing will be different from when it is rewarded every fifth time it presses the bar. The beauty of Skinner's system was that it was objective and therefore scientific. Operant conditioning also led to practical applications for humans, such as behavior therapy, in which the therapist applies Skinner's reward principles to change a patient's unwanted behaviors. However, beginning in the mid-1950s, changes were occurring in both psychology departments and popular culture that began the resurrection of the study of the mind. A paradigm shift toward the study of the mind. As behaviorism was dominating psychology in the 1950s, there were stirrings indicating that a paradigm shift was about to occur in psychology, where a paradigm is a system of concepts and experimental procedures that dominate science at a particular time, and a paradigm shift is a change from one paradigm to another. An example of a paradigm shift in science is the shift from classical physics, associated with the work of Isaac Newton and other 18th and 19th century researchers, to modern physics, associated with Einstein's theory of relativity and the development, by others, of quantum theory that occurred at the beginning of the 20th century. The paradigm shift in psychology was the shift from behaviorism, which focused solely on observable behavior, to cognitive psychology, which took the giant step of using observable behavior to make inferences about the operation of the mind. An event that played an important role in triggering the shift from behaviorism to cognitive psychology occurred in 1954, when IBM introduced a computer that was available to the general public. These computers were still extremely large compared to the laptops of today, but they found their way into university research laboratories where they were used both to analyze data and, most important for our purposes, to suggest a new way of thinking about the mind. One of the characteristics of computers that captured the attention of psychologists was that computers processed information in stages, as illustrated in Figure 1.2a. In this diagram, information is first received by an input processor. It is then stored in a memory unit before it is processed by an arithmetic unit, which then creates the computer's output. Using this stage approach as their inspiration, some psychologists propose the information processing approach to studying the mind. According to the information processing approach, the operation of the mind can be described as a sequence of mental operations. The diagram in Figure 1.2b is an example of an early flow diagram of the mind, created by the British psychologist Donald Broadbent in 1958.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?